Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, movie troopers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, Christmas is equal parts comedy and tragedy in The Holdovers, and David got to speak to its director, Alexander Payne. Grief manifests in surprising ways in All of Us Strangers. And on Film Club, it's a return to 1935's Merluce. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome back. It hasn't been long.
Yeah, indeed.
We're sick of the sound of us by this point.
But yeah, I mean, we've kind of covered pretty much everything there is to say about the most recent issue, Poor Things, currently on sale. So yeah, I thought maybe we could have a chat about, we're kind of deep in awards season, which is very boring a lot of the time, but are there any like big overlooked performances that you think haven't been getting any attention?
There was one the other day, and now I'm sitting down to talk about films. I can't think of what it was. I mean, I actually think that Paul Giamatti's been a little bit overlooked, but I mean, he'll probably get an Oscar nomination, so maybe not that overlooked.
Didn't he win like the Critics' Choice Award or one of the recent?
He won comedy at the Golden Globes. Yeah, but that was the first time I was like, oh yeah. Like, it's weird he's not had as much kind of buzz as maybe some of the other actors. I mean, I think Cillian Murphy's probably going to win the Oscar, but I'm sad Charles Melton has been getting nominated for stuff but not winning. That's my big kind of bugbear. He didn't get nominated for a Screen Actor Guild Award. May December didn't get nominated for anything at Screen Actors Guild Awards, which I think is crazy because it's a masterpiece.
I agree, but do you think part of that might come down to the bit of a backlash around Beavis Villy, who, I mean, it's very, very loosely based on something that happened to him, but he kind of came out complaining.
I think when that happened, it was already kind of after the deadline for a lot of places, not the Oscars, but for a lot of places. I think it's maybe, in the case of SAG, maybe it's that they don't like being perceived. It's a film about acting. It's about how acting and the kind of true crime industrial complex are unethical, so I can understand why they might be sensitive about that, but I do think it's a glaring omission. Otherwise, I mean, this film would have never got nominated for awards, but I actually think one of the best performances I saw this year was in the film Fremont. It's this actress, Anita Wali Zada. And she plays this young woman who's working in a fortune cookie factory in California. And she is an Afghani translator who moved to the US after serving, like helping the US military. And it kind of charts all her depression and isolation regarding that and her guilt and the way she's treated by the local Afghan community who regard her as a traitor. Anyway, it's a wonderful performance. And it's totally gone kind of under the radar this year, but that would be one that I think was great and should have got more plaudits than it did.
David, what about you? Anything that's going to have you rioting in the streets? I mean, personally, I think everybody who was all of the supporting actors in The Iron Claw should have been up for contention. I'm quite surprised none of them are.
Yeah, I guess that one kind of came a bit too late in the day. I haven't seen The Iron Claw yet, so I cannot neither confirm nor deny your suggestion there, but I think someone who I think's been on a real roll and has been recognised by the Academy and awards bodies for other films like Parallel Mothers is Penelope Cruz in Ferrari. I think, you know, it's a very meaty performance and she gets to do a lot of big emotions in the film. And, you know, in many ways, within the structure of that film, I think she could have been seen as the baddie or as the woman who is kind of shackling this male genius from being able to achieve his greatness. And I think that Cruz brings so much nuance to this role of one that I think she could have very easily just phoned in and done a kind of very like almost sort of sub Almodovar spurned lover type role. But like there are some really kind of amazing interior kind of dialogue scenes between Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz that are just like as intense as some of the race scenes in there because of the way that she's doing it, I think. And I haven't really seen, she's not really been in the running for anything so far, but yeah, I think it's a shame. But you know, there's a lot of other good options in there. And yeah, I also agree with May December, the May December crew.
Well, we should move on to our first movie, which actually has been getting a good amount of awards buzz. First up, it's The Holdovers.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
The Holdovers follows a curmudgeonly instructor at The Holdovers follows a curmudgeonly instructor at a New England prep school who is forced to remain on campus during Christmas break to babysit the handful of students with nowhere to go. Eventually, he forms an unlikely bond with a damaged, brainy troublemaker and with the school's head cook, who has just lost her son in Vietnam. But before we discuss the film, here's David Jenkins talking to its director, Alexander Payne.
When you're in Bologna, you said this really fascinating thing that has stuck with me.
I'm happy to say fascinating things.
And you talked about, I think you were talking about your personal print of Election, uh-huh. and how you had it in these kind of premium conditions. But then when you got it out and took a look at it after a while, and it there was still kind of deterioration there.
No, that was Citizen Ruth.
Oh, was that Citizen Ruth?
Yeah. So I have prints of all of my films. I don't have a print yet for this one because we need to get a better film out shot digitally. But anyway, yeah, someone, and most of these prints have never been projected. I'm keeping them for when I'm 90 and I'm like offered a retrospective in Karlovy Vary or something. And I'd say, well, I could bring my prints. We can't find this or that. Well, I've got one. But yeah, somebody wanted to, it was in Munich. They were doing a tribute to Citizen Ruth and they couldn't find a print. So I shipped one of mine over and it looked great. It had never been projected, but the optical stripe had deteriorated. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't hear it. And I remember Grover said, yeah, with a lot of those mid-90s Mylar prints, you know, the optical truck. So I actually now have to do a restoration on one of my own films, you know, and get out the mag and have a new, you know, shoot a new optical stripe, I guess.
The whole point of the whole discussion of that was about the kind of the technological
the arc.
Yeah, the arc and how you know it's the gap between having to do restorations is kind of narrowing when you think it should really be.
Yeah, and of course, all these archivists are very much concerned, and rightfully so, about digital because the technology changes so quickly.
Yeah,
you know, try to get a file off an old computer.
Oh,
you know, and it's all been within our lifetimes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can imagine the process of actually restoring Citizen Ruth would be kind of a nightmare, really.
Hopefully not a nightmare. Right. Hopefully the negative is in good shape. Uh-huh. It's just that optical. And then, anyway, I'm going to get into it, though.
Okay. In fact, one of the first questions I'm going to ask you about this, the Holdovers, was relating to, it's a bit, I guess, a bit Bologna-y, but like, I've read about you talking about the Marcel Pagnol film, Merluce.
Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, yeah.
Where have you seen it?
It's online. On YouTube.
Oh, so you saw it more recently?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you had seen it.
I hadn't seen it prior. Okay. No. When I'd read about that you'd mentioned it, I gave it.
What did you think of it? How is it? I actually don't remember it.
Oh, it's really good.
Good.
It's really funny.
You see the similarities between the two movies?
Well, I was going to ask you that question.
Well, I know it's got a similar setup. The idea is the same, but I think the stories go in wildly different directions.
Yes, yeah. I'd love
to. And the screenwriter, David Hemmingson, has never seen it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I just gave him the, supplied him a, with a basic premise.
Interesting. It, yeah. And where did you encounter this?
Telluride.
Ah, and was that part of a Pagnol retrospective or...
I don't know if it was just a recent restoration or they have guest directors every year who select 6 to 8 films to show. I don't know. Can't remember exactly why it was there. Although I will say, have you ever been to Telluride?
I've never been to Telluride.
So, you know, it was founded by Tom Luddy.
Yeah.
And Tom Luddy founded it 40, 50 years ago with the help of Alice Waters. You know who she is? She runs Chez Panisse, a famous restaurant in Berkeley, California, just outside San Francisco.
I don't know. I'm
all right, sorry. Anyway. There's a famous restaurant called Chez Panisse, and Panisse is taken from a Pagnol film, and you go into this fancy restaurant, everything there is Pagnol. And so, anyway,
yes.
I'm detouring.
Because it's funny you say that, because like, I remember at Bologna one year, I was watching this retrospective of Carl Lemel Jr. films. I think it might have been one of the years that
Carl Lemley?
Carl Lemley, sorry.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, who had Uncle Carl from Universal.
Yeah, yeah. And you watch so many of those films, and they're like 60 minutes long.
That's the perfect length for a film, isn't it? Like early pre-code movies, yeah. Early 30s movies.
But there's such strong ideas there. And I feel there's such a wealth. I was kind of feeling there's such a wealth of possibility of taking some of the germs of these like really, you know, not even B movies, I imagine, but like
programmers.
Well, indeed,
65 to 78 minute programmers. You go to see even Frankenstein. Speaking of Carl Lemley, I watched Frankenstein again the other. It's like an hour and 11 minutes, something like that.
I mean, one of the similarities between the Pagnol film and this is that they're films about schools, but they feel like prison movies as well. You know,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
I wonder if you had any.
You could throw in the loneliness of the long distance runner, which I think is kind of a juvenile hall movie.
Yeah. Was the prison movie ever a kind of?
No, never thought about it, but it's a good analogy to make.
Okay. Yeah, because it's like the people trapped there. Yeah.
If.
Yeah, indeed. So I'd love to know what the decision besides fielding this idea out to David was, and rather than having it for yourself and doing that writing.
Well, I can't write everything. I mean, some do, but it would be so nice to be like other big boy directors and farm out some ideas and let them get their, you know, like Steven Spielberg, not that he writes his own stuff, but... At any given time, I have no idea, but I would imagine 30 things are being developed for him, 40, 50, I don't know. And then he finishes one film and looks at his field and says, which one is near ripeness? And then plucks it. All right, let's fast track this one. So I want to be that to some degree with 2, 3, 4 other things going on that if I have an idea and a writer who I think is appropriate can get it up on its feet. Of course, I'll do rewriting and bevel the edges and make it directable by me, make sure it's within my vocal range. But I had this great idea for a movie, but I hadn't done anything with it because I knew I'd have to go out to New England to hang out at those schools because I'm not from that world and like harvest all the little details from which you make a decent story. But I'd never done that. And then I found this TV pilot by David set in a boarding school. So I just said, hey, man, I'm Alexander Payne. Would you write this idea for me? You will. Great. Thanks. Come on over. And that's how it happened. And thank God. It's kind of a miracle for him and for me. We both enjoyed the process a lot.
Oh, I'm interested to know, actually, because this is his first feature film credit.
He'd written a ton of TV.
Yeah. Is there a delineation there? Can you tell when someone's coming from TV and writing with the kind of a TV mindset? I mean, I as a viewer, I wouldn't get that, but I wonder if in the early drafts where there was like...
What would characterize TV writing? Things which are too facile or too...
Structure is probably the thing.
Like, you mean too by the number structure or...
I guess like the feature can have a sort of, I guess, grander arc, whereas TV has miniature arcs.
I would accuse to a TV writer, as I would accuse a playwright, of relying too much on dialogue and not juxtaposition of images or, you know, or like having too much damn dialogue. You know, TV shows like dialogue, movies resist dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I certainly had to cut out. I did a lot of editing.
Yeah.
Like my screenplay's tight. But no, he The answer is no.
Okay.
I didn't find any easy tropes, mm-hmm. other than maybe a little bit too verbose at times, but that's easily remedied.
When you kind of pitched this idea to him, at what point was the decision to set it during that era?
Well, we knew it had to be a period film because single-sex boarding schools don't exist anymore, mm-hmm. to speak of. So it had to be a period film. I was really itching to start making period films. All my movies have been contemporary, but it's like, mm-hmm. been waiting for the right moment. And then, I don't know, it just sort of happened. 1950s is probably too Peter Weir. Mm-hmm. If you're doing post-war, Peter Weir has the 50s. I don't know who has the 60s, maybe Lindsay Anderson. And then 1970, the 70s, we just had kind of a mental Ouija board that landed on 1970. Mm-hmm. And we both thought, oh, that sounds cool. You know, and then I could imagine films from that period because I was 9 years old, 9 and 10, and watching a lot of movies and still watch movies from that period. And then as a screenwriter, he had then tools to, as they say, up the stakes, yeah. for the characters. The Vietnam War is a sort of Damocles, and of course, killing that woman's boy. And mm-hmm. yeah, it just seemed to work. And he'd have more to say about it. I kind of poo-poo all this stuff, yeah. but he's like, oh, you know, that was a fulcrum time between, like he'd give you more detail. More rationale for why it was in the 70s. For me, it just felt right.
Yeah. I'm fascinated about like the sort of production design possibilities and like how much of that kind of stuff of like, you know, special wardrobes and costume departments and actual set dressing. Was it a big thing? Is it a product of a wealth of research and...
Yes. Yeah. And
this is from my naive idea of Hollywood as basically being like having a company where you say, I'm making a film in 1970 and they can just give it to you off the shelf.
No. And if they were to do that off the shelf stuff, it would maybe be unconvincing.
Yeah.
Or as many period films are, too cartoony in their sense of period.
Yeah. I love the fact that this is very non-pastiche of the
era. It had to feel lived in. I mean, the deal was, I was saying, we have to pretend that we're making a contemporary film in 1970. You know, I didn't have any like filmmaking things that didn't exist then. Mm-hmm. I mean, I rarely do anyway. I'm usually just a camera and a tripod and a dolly. That's it. I've rarely used a crane. You know, I've never used a drone.
Thank God.
You know, that kind of stuff. And fortunately, though, I had a production designer who in turn had a set decorator, set dresser. I always get those confused. The one who's in charge of the sets.
Yeah, yeah.
Who shared my aesthetic of uh-huh. wanting it to look in as lived in and beat up and banal as if we were making a low-budget film then. And we had a terrific location, Czarina, who knows the state of Massachusetts like the back of her hand, who was showing us, you know, relatively unchanged locations. Mm-hmm. And then for the costume designer, Wendy Chuck, she didn't have much of a budget. She had a really undernourished budget. So it wasn't so hard to cast to clothe the leads. It's tough to clothe all the extras.
Mm-hmm. And when did Paul enter into the mix?
Early on. Yeah. Oh, from the get-go, from the conception of the project, I knew I'd be giving it to Paul Giamatti if he'd take it.
Right. And the character for me, like among your other films, there is sort of lots of crossover with this. You do have some cantankerous older men in your film,
like Warren Schmidt.
Yeah,
is he cantankerous, maybe. Oh, Bruce Dern. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he was pretty curmudgeonly. Yeah,
and not to generalize, but there's one of the scenes about Schmidt actually that is really sort of stuck with me is a scene where he goes back into work to see if they need any help.
Yes.
And they're like, no, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, we're good, man.
And then as he walks out, he sees his kind of all his files and everything out by the bins.
Right.
And I love this idea of Paul in the film, in the Holdovers, as being this kind of a principled man out of time. Huh. Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting one to make.
There's a really interesting Guardian interview where you're talking about that. You know, you have identified yourself as a director of comedies in the same way that John Ford is self.
Yeah, I always say I'm making Western. A comedy, right?
Do you think there are kind of actors who are comedy actors? Because like Paul seems to me like a comedy actor. He's got this kind of natural comic ability.
He does. Who can also be devastating in dramatic scenes? Mm-hmm. But comic actors, who leaps to mind? Terry Thomas, Toto. Toto couldn't do anything and not be funny. Man, that guy. Yeah, but I don't know. But then I've had Giamatti, and he can do both. Mm. Well, there is no both. It's just all one thing with a spectrum to it. You know, human experience with humor. But all I know is he's delightful to look at.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think there are actors who can't do comedy?
Peter Sellers. Did Peter Sellers ever do a dramatic part?
I'm trying to think. Probably one of those 60s.
I don't know. You'd have to look through his filmography. Yeah. I mean, coming off the Goon show, you'd think he'd certainly be. Although it's interesting, one of his last parts in his Oscar-winning part in Being There, mm-hmm. he's funny, but in a serious way, isn't it? I mean, correct for the tone of that film, another Hal Ashby film.
Mm. Did you ever have any aspirations when you were kind of coming up in the industry to do any of the jobs like edit or cinematography or something? That's
never cinematography. Specific? That's too much like math.
Yeah.
For me, because it's like I just avoid it. I mean, I get involved with lens choice and shot design, of course, but lighting, I don't really. Like, I don't know if I missed the classes at film school where they explained what all the lights are. But I don't know. It's just I'm intimidated by it. Editing for sure. Mm-hmm. Had I not made it as a director, I might have gone into editing.
Do you think editing
is screenwriting too? Obviously.
Do you think editing is key to the comic aspect of your films, or part of the
hugely? Yeah. As Kurosawa used to say, the only reason I write and direct is to get things to edit. And when you're making a comedy. How we edit the picture together is of key importance. I'm saying obvious things. Yeah. Forgive me. I mean, it's obvious.
This is fascinating.
But you have to, and that's one reason we screen, we meaning Kevin Tent, the editor, and I screen constantly. Mm-hmm. But that even goes back to Harold Lloyd and Hal Roach. Mm-hmm. They screened the shit out of their films back then to mm-hmm. see where the laughs would fall. And those movies remain audience-proof to this day. Mm. If you ever go back and watch Harold Lloyd features, mm-hmm. But yeah, we have to begin to know the film predictably.
Yeah.
Oh, this always gets a big laugh. Oh, the audience gets a little bored here. Oh, we catch them there. And that's done through calibrating the film experience through editing and screening, constant screening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Time. Thanks for your interest. And I hope to see you.
So David, Alexander Payne's kind of, I believe his last film was the one where Matt Damon became very, very small. Is that right? Would you say
downsizing?
That's the one. Would you say this is a return to form? Has he increased in greatness?
I'm one of those sickos who actually quite like downsizing. So I unfortunately didn't get to tell Alexander Payne that in the interview we did, but maybe that's one for another day. Yeah, I mean, Downsizing was a film that he had been wanting to make since like 2010. While he was kind of doing getting that together, he made The Descendants and Nebraska in the interim. So that was like a huge, huge, you know, a massive like roll of the dice for him. And it didn't connect. And it was, you know, it was something very different for him. And you know, people didn't necessarily dig it so much. And yes, I definitely feel that that within about 10 minutes of this film, there is a definite sense of like, okay, he's gone back to what he knows, which is intimate, dialogue-driven character comedy that's very kind of literate and that's a little bit kind of elevated from your usual kind of knockabout Hollywood comedy. Having rewatched a couple of Payne's films ahead of doing the interview with him, I mean, it's not something I actually thought of beforehand, but he's a sentimental guy. I mean, he likes sentiment and a bit of schmaltz. And I think that The Holdovers is very much got that kind of almost Frank Capra vibe that he has brought to all of his films, where, you know, if you look at things like About Schmidt and Nebraska, they're about kind of you know, curmudgeonly old men who are kind of, you know, you get to see another side of them, or through the journey you spend with them, you kind of either you see them learning about the errors of their ways or find out why they are like that they are. And I think that the holdovers is no different. I think the key difference to the classic Alexander Payne mode of his previous downsizing films is that this is his first period movie. It's set in 1970, and to express that, he has created it in a way that definitely looks that is intended as a little bit of a pastiche of grainy, slightly freewheeling, like 1970s Hollywood, new Hollywood type movies of the type Pal Ashby would be making. The opening credits are styled in that kind of very like retro fashion, as if it's been like, even the Focus Features logo. Focus Features weren't around in the 70s, but they've created a sort of 70s Focus Features logo for specifically for the film. And the storyline, which, as you say, it's about a feared teacher, and it's set in a boarding school, and that there through a series of unfortunate events, Paul Giamatti's character is thrown together with Dominic Sessa's student Angus, who is a emo tearaway, and they clash initially, but throughout the film they kind of find a kind of common emotional ground. And I mean, it's a film I think which explores the very strange relationship that teachers and pupils have. Like, there's a kind of large emotional and personal divide between that, in that relationship between teacher and pupil, as there is sort of meant to be legally in most cases. And this film asks, like, what if that divide is broken down a little bit, and what if you actually learn about the fact that your teacher, who is this person who sort of is on this pedestal and you don't really understand and you kind of revere a bit and despise a bit, but what if it actually found out the kind of human quality? So, yeah, very much sort of Alexander Payne in his comfort zone, but not a bad thing.
And Hannah, I mean, the kind of third person in this trio is the person that I believe is getting, you know, definitely the most solid awards buzz. Not that that's, you know, the be all and end all of anything, but Divine Joy Randolph getting all of her flowers after... I think she should have been nominated for Dolomite Is My Name, but like, do you think that she's kind of deserving of being the one that's being picked out as like the sort of most impressive part of this acting wise?
I mean, I'm not going to argue with it. I think that all three of them are really great. And I think it only really works because of the chemistry between the three of them. But I mean, yeah, Divine is pretty great in this film, and I'm glad that she's kind of got to do something a bit more kind of...
Well, I mean, she's kind of a classic comic actress, but I think she's doing some... I mean, the nice thing about this is because sometimes you get like the comic actor who's just like, oh, look, I'm going to do a drama now. But they kind of do still play to the fact that she's got this sort of natural comic ability. Like, she is very funny in this, even though she's also heartbreaking.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the layeredness is nice. I mean, she's obviously like... she kind of got her start in theater and comedy, and I think she's really funny actually in The Lost City, which came out last year. She kind of steals every scene she's in that film, and actually I didn't realize that it was the same actress until today, and I was like, oh my god, that's where I recognize her from. But then I went back and I was like, oh, she's been in so much stuff and she's always been great. So it is nice that she's kind of getting that recognition, and I think it isn't the easiest role in the world, because you don't want to play it as kind of, you know, a caricature of like the stereotype of like the mammy character kind of that we know from like film history of like this, the black woman kind of like, you know, waiting hand and foot on the kind of privileged white characters in the film. But I think like the film is smart enough to kind of not make it feel that way. And I think that Divine is such a charismatic presence in her own right and brings so much kind of warmth and tenderness to the character. I could have easily watched like a 2-hour like Remains of the Day style film just about her, to be honest. And I whenever she wasn't on screen, and I was kind of like, let's just check back in with her, see what she's up to. Yeah, I think she's really, really great. I mean, for me, Dominic Sessa is like the big discovery here. He was only cast in the film because he's 21 now, he went to the school where they shot the film, and they had like an open casting call, and he auditioned, which is kind of a crazy way to land this like breakout film role. And I think he's really great, and hopefully we'll go on to kind of do lots more, because I think like that kind of bratty teenager role is so entrenched in film history, but there's this real kind of like vulnerability to Angus that I think he kind of captures very well. And even for both him and Divine, like going toe to toe with Paul Giamatti, who's kind of one of the leading actors of his generation, maybe a little bit underrated in that regard. I think
he's done a lot of bad movies.
Yeah, but he's good in them.
Fantastic actor, maybe not a fantastic chooser.
Agent.
Yeah, maybe not a fantastic agent.
I mean, he did Billions. People love Billions. I've not seen it. I can't say I have much interest in that series, but...
Well, do you like it when people have billions?
Well,
then do I have a show for you?
Is that what it's about?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, okay, no, that doesn't sound very interesting. I don't know. I mean, I like, actually, I think he's been doing a really good, like, awards circuit, and I loved all the coverage from the Golden Globes where he was on the red carpet talking about like how much he loved being in Planet of the Apes. I'm just like, what a guy. Like, he's talking about it with that kind of the utmost reverence. And yeah, I mean, he's someone who I don't think differentiates too much between like the good films and the bad films. He just turns up and always like does his job and commits, and I love that for Paul Giamatti. Yeah, you know, I'm happy that he's got something that is actually a good film.
Yeah, in some ways there's something a bit pretentious about only being in good films.
Yeah, you hear that, Adam Driver?
No, oh, I'm sorry, that dinosaur movie. Yeah,
that's what he did. That's he handled himself. Dinosaur movie.
Over the weekend, actually, a little bit of a Giamatti trivia. Me and my wife decided to put on the movie Donnie Brasco. Have either of you encountered Donnie Brasco? It's like a kind of mob movie with Al Pacino and Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Donnie Brasco.
And from like 94, I think it is, or actually. What year is it? Sorry, 97. Yeah, halfway through, there's a bit where Depp's character goes into this motel room, and in the background is like baby Paul Giamatti, and sitting there, and his partner is baby Tim Blake Nelson. So you got two incredible character actors just doing like one liner roles in Donnie Brasco, and it was like it was a proper kind of, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio meme of him like, that's yeah, that was me.
That was you.
Yeah, it's nice that the cream of that cast has risen to the top eventually. But yeah, we should get some scores on this because we've got another great movie to talk about. David, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'm probably going to give this one 4s across the board. I had a really good time with it. I think it's sort of peak Alexander Payne, if you will. And I think when I say that, that there, it does come with certain, for me, slight kind of structural flaws, and I think that it's that there is a sort of final act which is quite baggy. And you know, as I mentioned before, he is a director who does like a bit of sentiment, and there are a few touches where it's a little bit OTT. So it's something I'm definitely keen to revisit.
Hannah, what about you?
3, 4, 4 for me, I think. I'm really excited to rewatch it, actually. It's quite a while since I saw this now. I think I saw this in October, maybe. So that feels like a million years ago. Now we're in January. But yeah, I was a bit nervous after Downsizing, which I, unlike David, I hated and thought it was awful. I was a little bit kind of, had a few reservations, but I was, yeah, really pleasantly surprised. I think it looks great, it sounds great, all the love that they've put into making it feel like the 70s in kind of a very textured way. You know, it doesn't feel kind of synthetic, and I think that only comes from, you know, really caring about what you're putting on screen. Four for me.
Yeah, I'm probably at a 2, 4, 4, but the 2 comes from the release date. And I don't know if this was the same for our American friends, but the fact that I think this is such a wonderful film to have watched at Christmas, and I only watched it about a week and a half ago, kind of the fury of watching this in January when it would have been such a perfect Christmas Eve film or Boxing Day film to go and see with the family, slightly tempered it. But yeah, no, 4-4. It's funny. It's sweet. It's not histrionic in its tragedy, particularly with what happens with Divine's character. And yes, Alexander Payne is back, baby. Down your kind of, what is it, a spit bucket of wine that he has in Sideways. That has always stayed with me. Next up, it's All of Us Strangers.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One night in his near empty tower block in contemporary London, Adam has a chance encounter with his neighbor, Harry. As a relationship develops between them, Adam finds himself drawn back to his childhood home, where his parents appear to be living despite having died 30 years before. Hannah, God, where do you start with this? I had to leave the screening pre-Q&A because I was just in floods of tears.
Yes, I think were we at the same screening or were we at a different screening?
I don't know. If you saw someone make a dash for the door, I'm very sorry, Paul Mescal.
Oh, you were in the Q&A.
And Adam Scott. I couldn't stay. I was too upset. But yeah, is this more than sort of just tugging at the heartstrings, terribly sad stuff? I mean, do you think this has more to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the criticism that it's been making a lot of people cry and that's why they like it is a bit naive and a bit rude, to be honest. All films, in my opinion, I've written about this before, I've said this maybe even on the podcast, I think every single film is an act of manipulation. So, you know, we're really in the art of evaluating how successful that act was. And some people do not like that they've been made to cry, or they feel like they are being, you know, unfairly manipulated. But in the case of this film, I mean, Andrew Hay has always kind of worked in this mode of creating these stories about queer culture, about queer tragedy, queer loss, loneliness. You know, I think he is very kind of honest about the things that interest him as a filmmaker and how he wants to tell these stories. So it's not like this film came out of nowhere. You know, I think it's incredibly relevant to his artistic work. But also he said, you know, if you read the interview, which I did with him, which will be online next week for the film's release, you know, he says this is a very personal story to him. He grew up in the 70s and 80s, like during the AIDS crisis, as a child and then a young adult, like trying to kind of, you know, reconcile his sexuality with the great amount of tragedy that was happening in the world. And I think he's not coming at it from a perspective of, oh, this, everyone will relate to this because they've lost somebody at some point in their life. I think he's coming at it from his own kind of very, you know, unique perspective and his very unique reference points, the kind of music and the clothing and all the kind of 80s ephemera of his youth. It's all very specific, but there's that old kind of adage of like, the more specific you go with a story, the more it opens up and becomes relatable for other people. I'm not entirely sure how that works on a kind of psychological level, but I definitely, like, I found it incredibly moving. I think that the performances Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal give are fantastic, but I think that Claire Foy was maybe the standout for me. I think I'd never really seen her do something like this before. I think she's always done the kind of more showy, you know, stiff upper lip British things of like The Crown. And then she did Unsane with Steven Soderbergh, which I really did not care for. So seeing her operate in this kind of mode where she's basically parenting Andrew Scott, but treating him as though he is kind of a 12-year-old, but also kind of a grown man. It's like a very difficult task she has as an actress. And I thought she was wonderful. So I'm very much on board. I had to leave the screening I went to because I was like absolutely like not okay at the end of it emotionally. And then the second time I saw it, I said to myself, like, oh, I'm not going to cry the second time because I know every story beat, and I still cried. So, you know, I have a kind of strong emotional attachment to this film. I think it's such a profound and kind of earnest take on grief.
Yeah, I mean, I'd hate for people to listen to this and think that, like, oh, I should avoid this because it's something that's going to be, like, unendingly miserable. It's not at all. And I think the scenes, particularly between Andrew Scott and Claire Foy, they're beautiful, they're lovely, they're heartwarming, they're funny. And sure, it's devastating but it's sort of a little bit fait accompli. They've passed before the film has even started. So it's more kind of like the stunning opportunity of, like, what if you had a chance to, like, go and like have your relationship with your parents grow in a way that you'd been denied, I suppose.
I mean, it's really like catharsis, isn't it? It's not just the kind of grief, it's the catharsis. And I think that's something that maybe I should mention is that, yeah, that it isn't just making you cry to make you cry. It's about the kind of emotional release in some way, and whether that is to do with grieving or to do with love or to do with loneliness, that's more kind of what it is.
David, what about you? Did you cry? Sorry, not to kind of reduce it to that.
You know, my crying thing is that I don't tend to cry at things that are very sad. I cry at things that are very happy. That's a me problem, of course. I don't know what that's about. But that's not to say that I didn't find the film, like, you know, very affecting and what it was doing and saying to be, like, very profound. I mean, I would say that, like, coming at it from a slightly different angle to Hannah, like, the more I've thought about the film, I think it's easy to sort of look at this film about as being a very kind of human drama, and it's in that sort of template of, like, people interacting and talking and revealing themselves and having these kind of heart-to-heart things and the drama coming through character development. But I think at the same time, and this is not intended as an insult, but, like, there is something like M. Night Shyamalan about this film as well, where you have, like, there is a sort of, like, supernatural plot, or there are question marks about where are we? Why are we here? And what's the real reason for us being here? And will we get a revelation about this? Or will we find out about who this is and where this person's come from? And, you know, like, there is a sort of almost genre ghost story element a la The Sixth Sense at the core of this film. And I really liked how the fact that this felt like one of those kind of BBC Christmas ghost story movies, like, but sort of maybe delivered in a register that is a bit more open-hearted, melodramatic and political as well. So yeah, it's a film that's like, I think it operates on these two really sophisticated levels where the human insights and the trajectories of these characters and their sort of need to sort of express themselves about certain issues in their lives is so brilliantly done on a very kind of, I guess, a sort of detail writing level. And then you've got this sort of structural conceit as well that is also in the background. I mean, I know it's based on a novel, which I haven't read. So maybe Hannah, I know you've read it. So maybe that you could comment on whether that sort of structure is a bit more present in the novel.
Yeah, the novel is very different in some ways and obviously quite similar in others. What a nothing statement. But the novel is about, the novel is by a Japanese author, and it was written, I think, during the 80s and then translated into English only fairly recently, I think. And there was a film version made in Japan shortly after the book was released. But the novel centres on a heterosexual man living in Japan. And that's the kind of relationship thing there. And then the relationship with the parents, I would say, is kind of more sinister almost. Like it's more of a conventional kind of ghost story. Whereas this, I think, is less that. It's not, you know... Yeah, Andrew Scott's character has not kind of been haunted. And in the novel Strangers, there's a kind of more malevolent edge. Whereas I think this is, you know, about like the upshot of like letting go and kind of moving and working through grief. This is, the book is actually more kind of, yeah, there's almost like a energy vampire-esque element to the ghosts. But the book is very, very good. But I think it certainly feels like the thing that Andrew Hay was interested in was the framework, I guess, more than the actual, like, the kind of actual content of the story. And certainly, like, he brings all the kind of queer elements to the film that didn't really exist in the original.
I can't imagine that. It's like you've taken almost like all the stuffing out. Like that's so little connect, like all the elements that I thought was what it made it what it what is sorry that again that's not very well phrased, but yeah, all the elements that kind of seem to me to be like the actual core of this film didn't exist in the book then. That's really interesting.
No, yeah, I mean, the book's really good, it's just very different. I actually know a couple of people who are very kind of sniffy about Andrew Hay's film, and they're very much like, well, the book is so much better and the other film is much better, which is, you know, fine, entitled to that opinion. But yeah, they're both like well worth checking out. It's just, don't expect it to be exactly the same as this. But, you know, I think that's the kind of beauty of it. I think Andrew Hay really makes it his own kind of thing, and it feels so personal to him without being a kind of a memoir film.
So you should get some scores on this. Sorry, I'm curious, before you get some scores on this, book first or film first?
Oh, I actually don't think it really matters. Oh, okay. I saw the film before I saw the book, before I read the book. I think maybe do it that way, but you can't really get spoiled, I think, for this film. There is maybe one thing, but I mean,
Well, it's out this week. People don't have time to read a book first. This is the way they're going to do
it. It's out next week. They've got time. It's next week, next Friday. You can read a book in a week, guys. But I mean, yeah, I really don't think they're more companion pieces, I would say.
Okay. Well, scores-wise, what are you going to go with in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I'm trying to remember what I said in my review. I always worry about someone catching me.
Hey, you are a river flowing through life. Your scores can change, your perspective can change.
4, 5, 5, maybe. I mean, I don't know if I can give it a 5 for enjoyment, because like enjoyment is the wrong word, really. I just was kind of crying from like about half an hour in until the end of the film. But I do think it's a wonderful, wonderful film. And I think Andrew Hay is such a profoundly generous filmmaker. And certainly when I was interviewing him for Little White Lies, he's so generous with his time as well, and so open, and such a kind of great person to have a chat with. His screen talk from the BFI London Film Festival is actually on the BFI YouTube channel. Tim Roby did that interview, a friend of the pod, Tim Roby, did that interview, and it's really wonderful. So I highly recommend that for any Andrew Hay fans out there.
David, would you count yourself amongst those as a Andrew Hay fan?
Yeah. I'm actually a bit more into his kind of, you know, I'm really into his early stuff. like Weekend, and I love 45 Years as well, which this very much feels like a kind of return to in terms of the subject matter. It's almost like a kind of flip reverse version of 45 Years, but it has that kind of classic BBC ghost story element to it also. I'm probably going to give this 4s again over across the board, because yeah, I saw it a yonks ago myself, and I kind of feel that, like, yeah, that I agree that sort of it's heavy going, it's big, and it's really kind of it's sometimes really tough, because it kind of it's the stuff it's dealing with, you know, the psychological traumas that it's sort of couching in the narrative. I want to give it another go. I'm keen to see it again, and actually I've got to say, it's one of those films where I think it sort of has, you know, because it's dealing with time and perspective, and I think the world and geography isn't kind of conventional in the film. There may have been some bits that I kind of missed when I saw it and didn't, and I had to have explained to me at a later date. So I think now, knowing those things, I want to actually watch the film again and maybe properly understand it. So yeah, I am admitting that I maybe didn't understand what had happened in the film, which again is a me problem. There's so many me problems this week.
We're all having me problems.
I'm probably I also love 45 years, so it's probably a 4.45. I did find myself kind of half threatening people over Christmas with this film, where it's just like, yeah, you got some grief, you got some unresolved issues, you know what I've got. You know what they sent me on DVD.
It's a bit like that. Yeah, I was warning people that I know have had kind of like losses in the past year. I was like, maybe just like,
yeah, you want to pick up that scab?
Maybe be careful going into it.
But yeah, no, a beautiful film. And if kind of everybody in this ends up with, you know, at least with the British Film Awards getting lots of plaudits, I think that would be, you know, age very well, shall we say.
This is a film that's giving the BAFTAs a real open goal to actually do something worthwhile, and I hope they take it.
Well,
with a British film for once, yeah. Instead of like doing an American film, being like, oh, it's a British co-production. This is, come on.
I mean, they do it the season. Let's do it.
Well, next up, it's kind of a companion piece, I suppose, to our first film. It's Merluce. A tough teacher charged with looking after students left behind at a boarding school during the Christmas holidays rises to the challenge and comes to better understand the boys in his care. So, of course, David, this pairs perfectly with all of us strangers.
Indeed.
But, I mean, do you know, was this a direct influence on Alexander Payne and the Holdovers?
Well, I do pick it up in the interview, and hopefully listeners who kind of go into that, hopefully there's enough context there in the interview to get that this film was an influence. So it's a 1935 Marcel Pagnol film, and as Payne says, it's something that he caught randomly at one Telluride film festival during a kind of they have a thing at Telluride which is like a kind of free choice, and I think that it must have been programmed in that, where someone gets to program some oldies. And yeah, he saw it, and it kind of stuck with him, and he jotted the idea down, like the sort of general plot of the film, and said, could you, you know, sent it to David, the writer David Hemmingson, and said, could you do something on it? And yeah, ahead of my interview, I was like, you know, I'm gonna, just as a nice little talking point, I'm gonna try and seek it out and find it, and you know, it is there online for people who should choose to want to see it. And it's a wonderful little film, and yeah, it is about a teacher called Blanchard, who is has this nickname Merluce, which is a kind of, I think, some kind of like French slang term. I'm not entirely sure what it means. Maybe one of our French listeners can enlighten us on that.
Doesn't it mean like fish?
It's cod.
Is it cod? Because they say he smells like cod, doesn't he?
Yeah,
I think it means cod. Yeah,
right.
Oh, look,
okay.
At Hannah,
well,
and
there
I,
you go.
Citizens of the world.
Okay, so you're way ahead of me. So I wasn't entirely sure what it meant. But anyway, yeah, he's given this nickname, and as with Paul Giamatti's character in The Holdovers, the influence of Paul Giamatti's character in the Holdovers has a wandering eye, and the character of Merluce also has like a kind of very weird and unsightly glass eye, which he covers up with a kind of blacked out glasses frame. And this film is set in a definitely not as kind of plush boarding school in France. Like lower income kids are staying there, and it is the same setup of kids being left to stay at this boarding school over Christmas, and this grouchy teacher is the one who's set to look after them. And it's essentially like, instead, it's a 60-minute film, and the plot is, instead of, you know, they all think he's a grouch, but then he actually gives them all Christmas presents. They kind of realize the error of his ways, that he's actually, but beyond that kind of grouchy facade, he's actually a kind of caring and passionate guy. And it's short and very, very sweet. And the parallels with the holdovers are really just, they tickled me. As Alexander Payne, he didn't suggest that David Hemmingson watch the film. He only gave him a description of it. So it must have been Payne himself that brought a lot of these little kind of like ticks, and the fact that he wears a hat and the eye and the beard. Giamatti doesn't have a beard in this film, does he? Just a moustache. But this guy has a huge, bushy, unkempt beard, and he looks like a kind of monstrous in this film. And Giamatti doesn't look as much like that. But yeah, it's a delightful film that people should, fans of the holdovers should seek out.
Hannah, did Malus make you believe in the power of Christmas?
It's very charming. It's like an hour long, and what a delightful hour. I do think the special effects in the 30s were obviously not what they are today, and the eye felt like it was following me around watching the film. It's just a great time, you know. Remember when films could be an hour? Wasn't that crazy? It's a very simple story. I think that there are ways, obviously, that the holdovers kind of builds on that framework and builds it out, and I think the holdovers has a lot more kind of darkness in there than this film. This is really just, you know, it's just a teacher and some students kind of learning to understand each other a bit better. So in some ways, yeah, it's kind of a simpler film, but very, very charming. My first foray into what's his name, David?
Marcel Pagnol.
My first foray into Marcel Pagnol. I had a lovely little time with it.
Yeah, I would say if you're sick of watching It's a Wonderful Life every year, this time, in about 11 months' time, you'd do well to turn on Malus instead. Kind of just as heartwarming and, you know, not as sort of overwrought with a angel getting its wings or whatever happens at the end of that film.
It's definitely a Christmas movie deep cut. I hope to see that crop up on lists of great Christmas movies very, very soon.
I will put something in my calendar to pitch for that commission in about 8.5 months. Thank you very much for the idea.
So, David, do you want to go first? What is your non-movie recommendation for listeners this week?
Sure. At the moment, we're going to do a gaming pick. Last time I did a book pick, so it's either books or games, I'm afraid. Sorry, no TV for me. So it's a game called God of War Ragnarok, which is a sequel to the game God of War. And it's essentially a game where you're playing this grizzly guy called Kratos and his son Atreus, and it's set in a kind of prehistory time of gods, Odin, Thor, all these kind of people. And you know, you're sent out to avert Ragnarok, which is the kind of end of days. And the thing that is great about the game actually is that it's one of very few games, like usually when you have cutscenes and cinematics, you have a little button that you can press to skip through them because you want to get to the game and you want to get playing and hitting people and throwing axes and whatnot. But in this game, you can't skip the cinematics because it's so integral to the actual arc of the story. And what's really interesting about this game, and I think people have, it came out end of 2002, so I'm a bit late to it, but a lot of people have written about how this crossover between movies and games, and this definitely feel like I'm actually kind of getting to the end of it now, and there's actually some really powerful moments in the game, like some huge sort of twists in the storyline that are really done in a really dramatically effective way. I mean, I haven't probably played enough games to be able to sort of describe it as a revolutionary game, but I've certainly never, like in most games, the storyline comes as a kind of afterthought, as a way to kind of string together the actual playing elements. And this one, it feels there's a lot more equality between actually trying to fuse those two elements together and actually make it into a proper sort of narrative and drama. It's one of the things that's that is amazing about it is that they've got, you know, you guys will probably know this, but it they've got the actor Bradley, someone who was in The West Wing. It's Richard Schiff from The West Wing. You definitely know him if you saw him. He's kind of like a little kind of slightly unassuming, very sort of deadpan guy, and he plays the antagonist in the game, Odin. And he's giving an incredible performance, and it's one of the best movie villains I've seen in a long, long time, and it's just very weird that it's part of a game. So yeah, heartily recommend that. But I know that, obviously this is, I'm late to the party, but I'm sure lots of people have played it and know all this already, but I'm now on it. So there you have it.
One of these days, I'm going to invest in some sort of console and trust in my hand-eye coordination to actually do these things.
You do too much already. You can't do games as well. Your brain will explode.
It is a time suck.
Well, I mean, I make time for reality TV. That does sound a lot more worthwhile than Real Housewives of Salt Lake City or whatever it is that I somehow carve out an hour for once a week. Hannah, what about you? What is your recommendation?
So mine is a book, and I don't think I recommended this last week. The problem is with doing this podcast for a few weeks in a row is you kind of run out of things because your whole life is watching movies. You're like, oh God, what do I do that isn't watching movies? Anyway, I am recommending the book Mickey 7 by Edward Ashton, which is the basis for Mickey 17, the Bong Joon-ho film, which is coming out hopefully this summer. We don't know yet. But yeah, I started reading it last week, beginning of this week, and I'm not very far into it yet, but I'm having a great time. It's very funny. It's a sci-fi novel about a man who is a replicant, and he's been hired by this kind of space exploration company to basically be the guy they send in to do all the dangerous menial tasks, and he's expendable because they can replace him with a clone. And when we meet him, he is about to die for the seventh time. So yeah, it's just really fun. I definitely can see why Robert Pattinson was cast in the film version, because he's kind of a loser, the character, and Robert Pattinson does that very well. There's giant centipedes, there's kind of this oppressive loom of this big capitalist company who don't really care about people. And yeah, I mean, say I'm not super far into it yet, but it is really fun. And if you're wanting to kind of prep for Mickey 17, it's probably a good one to pick up now, so you can be like, oh, I read the book and the book was better, or the book was worse. I don't know, we'll see.
And we're kind of fingers crossed for maybe when this film comes out, or is that just kind of wishful thinking on Twitter?
I hope so. I could see it, because it's 5 years since Parasite, so it would be like kind of, you know, a nice like little symbolic thing. And I mean, it sounds like it's finished. I think it's just like Warner Brothers kind of rejigging the schedule a bit. There's no way they're going to can it. they're not going to can the next film from the guy who won Best Picture. So
you say that. I think we will get to see it.
Oh God, where you've jinxed us.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry to be cynical, but you know, who knows?
Pattinson would never let that happen. He'd do a heist. He's that kind of guy. Him and Bong breaking into the vault.
But what happened also to the Parasite TV show? That's been kind of in the pipeline for a while, and I haven't heard anything about it recently.
Yeah, Will Ferrell was exec producing.
So I don't know why I'm talking to you as if you are like Bong Joon-ho's representative.
I mean, we did do the book on him. I think they decided it wasn't a very good idea. I seem to recall that it isn't happening anymore. I think that, yeah, it quietly was kind of like, actually, we don't need to do this. Because it was going to be an American, like, kind of version. And it's just like, we don't need that. And we've kind of got the curse now, which almost feels like, yeah, it feels like, obviously it's not about the same thing, but it feels like that's a kind of, I don't know, Parasite-esque take on the American class system and homes, the housing market. That's my hot take.
What a final episode that was, my goodness.
Should have recommended that. I can't remember if we have recommended. We probably have recommended The Curse before.
I think you have recommended that, to be fair. I hope people took your recommendations strongly enough that they stuck through to the end, because it really is a doozy.
A great finale. Yeah, really good. But go in not knowing anything about it.
So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon or tweet us at LWLies. Next time, we'll be talking Zone of Interest in American Fiction, and I talk to Cord Jefferson and Jeffrey Wright. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leigh Lateef, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.